This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, a United Nations envoy is kicked out of Darfur, and a school busing program in Birmingham, Alabama may come to an end. Joining us today from our New York bureau is Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. We've got Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist in our Chicago bureau, and from member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, Glenn Lowry, professor of the social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University. Thank you all for joining us, and let's start with the busing in Birmingham. For 35 years, there's been this court order busing black children from a place called Oxmoor Valley to what used to be a 99% white and still is a 94% white suburb nearby. Now, Oxmoor has changed a little bit. It's gone from a real poor working class community to black professionals as well. But the basics remain. Oxmoor is black. The school nearby is very much white. The desegregation order wasn't supposed to be lifted until the school system in this white area was 25% black. It's still only 7% black. Glenn, is this there's been a huge trend of overturning desegregation orders, even if they haven't been fulfilled. Is this kind of a lost cause, or should there be some way to continue remedies for segregation?
Well, I think the wheel has turned, actually, on an era in American social policy around schools and race. I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to decide in this case upcoming where they have to rule on the constitutionality of assigning students to schools by race in some other districts, but it's a conservative court, so, you know, we better brace ourselves. And the other point that I would make here, you know, the fundamental issue here is that the resources available to schools differ because of local autonomy of school control and local tax reliance. They differ by the incomes of the communities that people live in. The complaint of some of the people who want to see this busing order lifted is that the people coming in from the black community in Birmingham don't pay property taxes out there. And the truth of the matter is, if you can afford to pay the property taxes in an upscale suburban community, you can afford to buy good public schools for your kids. And if you can't, you can't. And that's not really a matter of race. That's a matter of cash.
Well, Laura, how about this? I mean, it is a matter of cash, but at the same time, you know, and this is a debate that could go on and on and on, but if you look at why people earn what they do, at least part of that is due to race. So at some point, is there a compelling government interest that says, well, we realize not everybody may be able to buy their way into a good school district? Or what other remedies are there?
Well, I agree there should be a compelling government interest if we assume and if we agree that the government has a responsibility for educating young people, especially educating young people who don't have the other options that maybe the people who are paying high taxes do. And in fact, we have a very inequitable double standard public school system throughout this country for different reasons in different parts of the country. But the bottom line is, if you don't have the bucks, whether you're white, black, or whatever, you are not going to have the access. And I think government does have the responsibility to find a way to provide equal access. I think, though, that Glenn is correct in that we have passed into a new era. And part of the issue, I think, has been, in some sense, there's been a backlash in some communities from the African American community about busing and about desegregation and the cultural and sociological position that we should demand equal schools, economically viable schools in our own communities, and not be forced to demand or go to white communities in order to get the education that we value.
But Laura, if the federal government is, mm-hmm. I understand it, only contributes 8% of school budgets and the rest of it is state and local, then it's going to be pretty difficult to have that kind of equity in black schools.
Absolutely, if you're just going to rely on federal government, but I think you put your finger on the pulse of this. State and local have to do their fair share. We've been in this fight in Illinois and Chicago for over a decade now about inequitable school funding. If you look at suburbs throughout the Chicago area, there's a vast inequities, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases in terms of per pupil spending depending on the part of the community they live in. A lot of those issues come down to state taxes, come down to local taxes, come down to local governance, and there has been a resistance on the part of the wealthier communities, the legislators in the wealthy communities, to equalize and to level the playing field.
Michael, give me your thoughts, because I know that you're not a big fan of schools that are specific for a certain race, But what about schools that have a history of being segregated? I mean, do we have an obligation to desegregate them?
Of course you do. And this is not a case of like the other cases. The other cases have been school systems that were under desegregation plans or orders. And the mandate was to eliminate school segregation root and branch, and to the point where you had a unitary school system. And where you got that unitary school system, in other words, they're no longer racially identifiable, or the populations have shifted to a majority-minority population as opposed to a minority going to a majority, then people sought, quote-unquote, relief, saying, why are you still under a desegregation order? This is different because Davia Hills is a white suburb of Birmingham. They are claiming overcrowding. Now, in the last 4 years, you went from 75 bus black kids to 132. Well, I'm sorry. This is not overcrowding. Overcrowding is not itself a constitutional standard. It is, in my judgment here on these facts, a ruse. And not only that, you have the Vestavia Hills community having recently annexed two mostly white communities. So this is a different situation from the others, and my prediction is that the courts will say, now, you're not getting out here. You know, it's like the old saying, it ain't the bus, it's us. I think there is the indication here, the evidence here, is that this is animus towards racial integration. Now, with respect to what Laura and Glenn said, I think we need a compelling state interest. We need more people talking, public officials and people, the grassroots, NAACP. Hey, NAACP, NAACP. We need more of them talking about the value of integration. And because they have forsaken integration, they have gone to this racial separatism nonsense that separate can be equal. Well, the Supreme Court in 1954 said separate is inherently unequal, and that integration advantages white students as well as black students.
I'm not sure the NAACP says that that separate is okay, but let me give you an example. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make one point, and this is not in contra to what Michael is saying. I just want to say, however, though, that we might want to consider the limits of the courts vis-a-vis state legislatures as a place to have this kind of discussion about equity and the finance and provision of public education to kids. I think that African Americans, basically the world is changing, man. We're in the 21st century now. There are a lot of Latinos and Asians in the mix here now. And I think this long argument that we have had with white America about segregation has basically been exhausted. I'm not saying it's worked out right, but it's been exhausted. Now we have to talk about equity. And I think that state legislatures ought to be countering the natural tendency for local communities to take care of their own, the rich communities to take care of their own, and distributing state-level educational finance in a counterbalancing way that allows for the less well-off districts to have more resources to get effective educational equity to their kids. And that's where I think we should be having this argument, not in the courts, but in the state legislature.
It's always about equity. But you cannot put equity against the interests of minority education with respect to equality. And you can't put equity against access. You can't put equity against desegregation. Desegregation is about equity. Integration is about equity. Desegregating white suburbs is about equity. Getting people to stop talking nonsense is about equity. So those blacks who compromise, who subjugate, who say, well, I don't want integration anymore, that's just...
But Michael,
that's
here,
just nonsense.
Let me just give
nonsense.
You an example from my own life. You know, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I started out at an all-black school in my neighborhood, which was pretty much an all-black neighborhood. The school wasn't very good. It was eventually shut down. But before it was shut down, my mother sent me to, you know, a sort of magnet school that was mixed. And then I went on through the public school system, but at these mixed schools, which were only a handful. Most of the schools were very much black, and the white kids, for the most part, didn't go to the public schools or only went to schools that were heavily white. How can you talk about desegregation when still, in so many, you know, urban areas, there's just not a willingness of non-black parents to put their kids in school?
I got the point. And the majority of minority kids who go to these urban areas, which are segregated schools, those kids are consigned to the dung heaps of the school system. There's no question about that. And in that regard, yeah, you got to have equity. I'm talking about a particular situation here of Vestavia Hills, a white suburb that has 132 black kids, and they're talking about the schools overcrowded. I remember when I was bused from Harlem to a school, a white school in New York City, 50 of us, and the school was overcrowded, they said. I don't buy it.
But Farai, you know, I think you are right, correct, in that the vast... You had a singular opportunity. I went to an integrated high school as well. The vast majority of urban black kids, a different situation than the one we're talking about today, do not have that kind of choice. Michael is right. They are at the bottom of the list. They, because of the segregation of their school systems, because of the segregation of their communities, they are never going to have that kind of option. No Child Left Behind was supposed to have addressed those kinds of inequities,
right.
But we know what happened with that.
Well, let me move on to another topic. Okay. You just had a UN envoy, Yan Prunk, thrown out of Sudan. That was one of the latest gestures that the UN has made to try to really deal with the ongoing genocide in Sudan. I mean, at this point, are the UN's hands tied? Are the U.S.'s hands tied? Glenn?
Yeah, you know... the Sudanese government is resisting the deployment of UN forces there. There are some 200,000 dead, 2 million people displaced. They think the UN isn't going to be an unbiased observer of what's happening. And my God, how could the UN possibly be an unbiased observer of genocide? I think it reveals the complexity of the situation. Evidently, the army is embarrassed by what a UN envoy wrote on a website and have somehow maneuvered within the Sudanese government to get the UN envoy expelled, even though it's going to be a bad political hit for them. The U.S. government, because of what we're doing in Iraq, doesn't have the juice, doesn't have the good offices and the diplomatic capital to be able to actually do something here. And we certainly can't talk about putting any forces on the ground, given our overcommitted situation. So... it's a mess.
Well, my view is, you know, this is Michael Myers. My view is that this envoy must have wanted to go home to his kids and family. You know, you have to acknowledge the high dungeons of the expulsion order. You know, get out of town by high noon, and you don't want to be in a Sudanese dungeon hanging by your fingertips. You just don't. So you get recalled home. But how do you have a UN envoy having a blogger with opinions about the Sudanese army, how do you expect not to be sent home? So he has lost his neutrality, if not his credibility.
Well,
so
Michael,
he wanted to go home.
I think what it points to is and again, I'm not there, but it sounds to me is like the desperation of the situation, that he feels that this is the only way he can get the message out. And I think that there's a good reason for that, because we as journalists and other folks who are supposed to be putting this story out there are not. That story is just not in the news. If you see anything on international issues, and you many days can go by when you don't, it's Iraq.
Yeah.
And Glenn's point about stature of the United States, I think it's true of the United States. I think it's through the UN, again, because of Iraq. We've lost our luster. We've lost our status in the world. We're to the point where a UN envoy can be thrown out of a country that has this kind of a spotlight on it. That says a lot about the lack of power and the weakness of the U.S. and the U.N.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right. Well, we've got one more topic.
And the power of the military.
One more topic I want to get to, and this one is very, I don't know, ephemeral, lighthearted, perhaps.
Ugly?
More ephemeral. So, you know, everybody, you know, we have been getting some complaints that we do silly stuff on the roundtable. All I want to say is I'm down for at least one silly thing. When you go, you're talking about genocide, you need something silly. So in Omaha, Nebraska, an ordinance bans smoking in nearly all public places, as with California. Now elected officials and police want residents to call 911 if they catch a smoker in an undesignated place. The first thing I thought of was those, like, ghetto T-shirts that say stop snitching or whatever it is. And, you know, it's like if you found out that your neighbor had turned you in for smoking, like, in a, you know, a public plaza, wouldn't you be mad? Laura?
Well, yeah, it would be, but it's not happening there. You know, this 911 policy is just a gimmick. The officials there, the authorities report that, you know, no one's calling. People are smoking on the street, smoking wherever they want to smoke. It sounds like it's a gimmick to me. It's kind of overkill. You know, I'm very much anti-smoking, but my other philosophy about that is people want to kill themselves, go ahead. And I think that the 911 services has been pointed out need to be focused on things that really matter.
Well, here in LA, you know, if you're not bleeding, it's pretty hard to get police action. Sometime I was rear-ended once, and I called to try to get an officer, and it was just like, handle it yourself, honey. So, what's going to happen in Omaha if 911 is flooded with calls? Well, absolutely flooded, Michael.
I don't think this is a silly topic. I thought you were going to talk about the silly topic of politicians who are ugly. No, this is not a silly topic. This is a public health concern. Now, calling 911 and to report smokers is not going to work in New York City, obviously. It may be able to work in Omaha, but it's an awful approach to law enforcement. But the phones are not being flooded at 911 in Omaha, apparently, because people are respecting the law.
They are respecting the
rule of law.
It's because people are not bothering. It's silly.
Well, I don't think it's silly because I have to tell you something. If I lived in Omaha and somebody started lighting up in a restaurant in which I was trying to enjoy a meal or lighting up in my office building, I'd call 911. I'd call somebody, the public health department, somebody to get them to respect the law and to respect my health. Of course they can kill themselves, but they can't kill me. The secondary smoke are very serious. It's not a silly topic.
And even if they weren't, even if the effects of the smoke weren't killing you, and I guess there can be some doubt about that, it's still something that you don't want. The smoker is imposing on us, if we don't want to smell the smoke when he or she lights up. You know, I mean, too bad we have to do it through the law. Too bad courtesy.
Yes.
Hasn't advanced to the point where you don't light up a cigarette in a room full of people when you know that maybe 15 or 30 or 50% of them really, really don't want to smell the smoke.
Yes.
Too bad. I mean, we don't break wind in public willy-nilly because we are deferential to the sensibilities of our fellow citizens. So too might smokers be with respect to non-smoking smokers. But for now, it's the law.
Well, on that note,
there comes a limit to being selfish.
There's laws and there's laws.
Well, that's a good law.
On that
I respect Omaha.
All right. Well, with a whiff of controversy, Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, thank you all for a fragrant conversation.
Oh, you are most welcome.
I had to do
thank
it.
Thank you, Variety.